stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 181 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. For the last time ever, I am coming to you from my apartment in San Francisco, California. I am Andrew Brokus. I am about to move. I probably will end up back in San Francisco again, but I am in the process of leaving my current apartment. Co-host Nate Mavis, who will be joining us momentarily, actually also just changed apartments. So this episode, we don't really have a full-on introduction and strategy segment and all that kind of stuff. We do have a couple little bits of news and a great interview coming up for you. Just kind of between the business of the World Series of Poker and both of us moving, just not a lot of time for us to sit down and record together right now. Do want to make sure that I give a shout out to Chris Kusha. Chris is a Tournament Poker Edge member who just went very, very deep in the main event, finished 27th, meaning he made day 7 of the WSOP main event, won, I think, $250,000 or so for his efforts, so surpassed both my biggest cash in the World Series and my deepest run in the main event. Huge congratulations to Chris, of course. Chris actually said that he got offered $500 to wear an 888.com patch while playing the main event and turned it down so that he could continue repping Tournament Poker Edge. So just a great example of how much Tournament Poker Edge can do for your tournament poker game and how much the Tournament Poker Edge community means to the people who really take it seriously. I don't want to speak for Chris, but I imagine that Tournament Poker Edge was a big help to him in achieving what he achieved in the World Series of Poker. And no matter where you are in your poker game, Tournament Poker Edge certainly can help you as well. We've got an interview coming up with Ian Simpson. Ian is a British poker pro, a very interesting guy, very nice guy. Nate and I actually both had the chance to meet him in Las Vegas. I even played with him briefly during a Venetian Deep Stacked event. We recorded this interview actually before the World Series of Poker, and it just kept getting preempted by WSOP content, and it was very handy to have it in our pockets to pull out now for this week's episode so that we wouldn't have to skip a show. Thanks for your patience with us. Hopefully we'll be back to a more normal schedule, more normal episodes very soon. One of the great upsides of the World Series of Poker is that it is a good networking opportunity, and I know that I was able to meet a couple of people in Las Vegas and get commitments from them to come on the show, so I don't want to drop any names just yet, but I think we've got some pretty exciting stuff coming up, and in fact, exciting stuff coming up right now in this very episode with Ian Simpson. Thanks for joining us, Ian.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So are you doing any World Series of Poker this year?
Oh, I can't wait. I'm going out there in about a week's time.
Are you?
I was going to go out like a week ago, but being married to Emma, I've got to be very conscious of sort of the balance between live poker trips that she can't actually come with me on because of her work commitments, and you know, getting the right balance between her and poker. And I've been away a lot recently, like the past, I don't know, month and a half. I've been away like 3/4 of it. You know, and I get a bit crazy if I'm out in Vegas for a month anyway without her.
Oh, I hear you on that.
Yeah, so I put the trip back a week so I could spend more time with her, relax, get myself nice and chilled out before heading out there and hopefully bagging a bracelet. That's always the plan, right?
That'll be the plan. I was planning on that.
We've got a plan on that every year. It's going to happen.
What does the perfect balance look like for you? Do you have a sense of, you know, how much time you try to spend playing versus doing other things?
I haven't got that right yet. I don't think anyone's got that right, have they? If someone's got that right, let me know who they are and I'll pick their brain. But yeah, it's always tricky because you know, my schedule is working at nighttime, whereas my wife works at, she's a teacher. She works for, well, she works too many hours. She works from like 7 a.m. till like 5-6 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And then I start grinding. So if I grind too much, I just don't see it because our clocks are, you know, polar opposites. So I try, at the minute I've been grinding like 3 nights or 4 nights a week and trying to do hand histories with my boys sort of while she's at work. But of course, on top of that, you've also got to balance your social life, seeing your friends, seeing your family. So it's really hard. It's not something I've mastered yet. It's something I'm always very conscious of, though, because it's very easy just to devote all your time to poker. It can just, you know, if you give it all your attention, which is very easy to do because I love the game, you know, other areas of your life suffer. So.
And you're restricted, or you kind of feel like you have to be grinding in the evenings because of that's how the PokerStars schedule is set up?
It's not necessarily just PokerStars. My grind's split across a few sites, but they're always the best tournaments, aren't they? They're always the sort of the biggest guarantees and things like that. I've done the occasional daytime grind, which is fine, but obviously, you know, the bigger guarantees are always the lure, so.
What's the, maybe we should back up a little bit. You know, where are you from? How'd you start playing poker? That kind of.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, I'm from Newcastle, which is in the northeast of England. And I started playing poker when I was like 5 years old. I was at the in the Lake District with my parents and my brother. And it was terrible weather because, you know, it's England. So we sat in the caravan where we were staying and just played 5-card draw. And that's how I learned. And I played like with matchsticks and just, you know, essentially play money until like, I don't know, I was 10, 11, 12. Then I started playing for a little bit of real money. Just, you know, pennies here, pennies there with my friends. And then when we were 16, we started playing. The stakes just, you know, gradually got a little bit higher. They never got too silly with just my friends. But yeah, that's how I started. The way I got into it professionally was kind of an accident. Like, I always loved poker. And in university, I paid my way through, like, my third year of university through playing online poker. Back in the good old days when you just had to, you know, make top pair and bet and you'd make money, you know? I miss those days. But yeah, I got a qualification as a teacher maybe 7 or 8 years ago now. And I absolutely adored my teaching job. I was working at Bedlington High School in the northeast of England. And absolutely loved it. But I qualified for the Irish Open in 2012. And Paddy Power had this promotion on. It was last longer bet. They were giving a €100,000 sponsorship package to the longest lasting online qualifier. And I got fourth and I won that promotion. Now, what this meant was, on top of the 106k I won for coming fourth in the Irish Open, they put another 100,000 up, and 50,000 of that had to be used in tournament buy-ins. Now, I absolutely loved my teaching job, but looking at the teaching holidays, because teachers can't take any extra time off, at least they can't in England, looking at the teaching holidays and looking at the poker schedule, there was absolutely no way I could spend this 50k and keep my teaching job. So I had to choose between the two. So thinking that the 50k tournament buy-ins and the expenses money would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, you know, I'd get to go to all these places, I'd get to do what all the Phil Hellmuths and the Phil Ivies and all these heroes do that, you know, go and play in these big tournaments all over the world. I figured, right, I'll do it for a year. So I did. I left my teaching job. I tried to, you know, I planned to go back to it a year later. But the governors at the school wouldn't give me a year out. They said it's, you know, like an Olympus, you can stay or go. So I left, which is a shame because I really loved the school.
Yeah, that seems really short-sighted on their part.
Yeah, I mean, especially because I was, like, not to blow my own horn, but I worked really damn hard at teaching, you know? So yeah, that sucks. But yeah, so where was I? Yeah, so a year later, I had this, well, I grinded this 50k bankroll for a year. I remember I turned it into about 35k, so like kind of like a 15k loss. But I had one more tournament to go, which was the Irish Open again, and I came back and won it. So from then I've just kept playing. Yeah, I had like another score, like I don't know, 3 or 4 months later in a UK IPT, I got a second place. But yeah. That's how I got into poker.
Yeah, see, that's where I thought the story was going, was going to be either that, you know, you just ran really well during that year, or just decided that you liked not working and didn't want your job back. I wasn't expecting that they wouldn't have you.
Yeah, I mean, I think they might have had me. It's just that they weren't willing to sort of guarantee the job when I came back.
Do you think you still would have wanted to go back if you had if that had been on the table?
I mean, I absolutely love the job. I love the people I worked with. I love the school. I love the kids. And I really miss it. I still miss it to this day. And it's still not something I've turned my back on. I think I will end up in a classroom again one day. It's just, at the minute, poker's going really well. I'm really enjoying it. So I'm going to stick with poker for a while. As it is, I need to look into the exact rules, because I think my teaching qualification might run out if I don't do some teaching next year. So right when I feel like I'm at the peak of my poker career, I feel like I'm playing my best that I've ever played, I might have to leave, which kind of sucks.
Is it that hard to get a new qualification?
I don't know the exact rules. When I first applied to do the qualification, there was sort of a reasonably vigorous selection process for who could do the course. I don't know if it's still as vigorous, because teaching in England is pretty brutal nowadays, and they're a little bit more desperate for teachers. So I'm really going to have to do some research and, you know, look into it. But I'll probably end up being in the classroom this year, so that could be fun.
What do you teach, or what were you teaching?
I taught biology, which I actually think I've had a lot of conversations with people from maths backgrounds and people from science backgrounds. There's not that many poker players from a science background, but I would argue that it's a very, very good background for poker. Everyone automatically assumes that that maths is the best background for a poker player. But science is all about analyzing evidence and analyzing data. And science is all about using evidence to make good decisions, which is exactly what poker players do. You know, we gather evidence, we look at our plays, we think, okay, so three betting with these kind of hands is profitable because, and then they three bet with those hands and they make money. So I think the sort of evidence-based mindset that I've got is pretty good for poker.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of received wisdom going around the poker world, and even more so a few years ago, that certainly would benefit from being subjected to the scientific method.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think an evidence-based approach, I mean, that's how I live my life. It's just, you know, the mindset I've had drilled into me for the past, 10 years I've been studying science, I guess. So, it was my degree in school, and as a teacher I studied science, and you know, I still love science. I still sort of recreationally follow the big science stories, so that's you know, the basis of my mindset.
And I mean, there's plenty of math in science. You just have to learn enough math to get the job done, right? and it's the same way in poker, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, maths, depending on, I mean, that's the beauty of poker. There's people from a maths background can beat the game. People from a science background can beat the game. I've got a friend, you guys know David Lappin. He's part of the firm. He's a professional online grinder anyway. And he's got a doctorate in philosophy, and he's beaten the game.
And Nate's well on his way to a doctorate in philosophy.
Is he really? Excellent. Nice one, man. I'd love to pick your brain about that, because I stayed up till like 6 a.m. with Lappin the other day when I was in Malta, drinking tequila and talking philosophy, which was a hell of a lot of fun.
That sounds great. You can have all the tequila. I'll take care of the philosophy. So
That sounds great. But yeah, that's what I love about poker. There's all these different mindsets and backgrounds, and all these different mindsets and backgrounds can beat the game in different ways, which is, you know, fun.
And I guess biology is nice in that everything you learn in high school is actually wrong or a gross simplification, which is another useful preparation for poker.
Was that a dig at biology there?
No, not at all. It's fascinating. I worked in the field. I have a bioinformatics background. And
oh, really? My final year project at uni was bioinformatics.
Oh, interesting. It's nice. It's but you know, things. You know, it turns out to be very hard to give like an acceptable definition of a gene that doesn't have counterexamples.
Exactly. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a simplified picture, you know, DNA, RNA, or DNA, protein.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yes. And in the further educated you get, the more things you learn that sort of, I remember being taught things at GCSE, and then when I got to the next level of education, the teachers were like, well, we're sorry, but we'll have to simplify that. You need to forget that and learn this new idea.
How, what was your poker life balance like back when you were teaching? I mean, it, you must have been reasonably good to have had the results that you had. I mean, how did you find time to play poker while you were working the long hours of the teaching?
I didn't. I barely played when I was a teacher. I played the occasional, I'd play like one table and play satellite, you know, just for the joy of playing a satellite, because there's no bigger rush for me. It's still the same. There's nothing more exciting than playing a satellite that'll qualify you for a live event. You get to go see somewhere new and play cards. There's nothing more exciting than that. And as a teacher, I was working like 60, 70 hours a week, so I just did not have time for poker. I'd play my 5p, 10p home game on a Friday night, maybe twice a month, and I'd play an online game once a month, something like that. You know, I mean, when I was at university, I played, I don't know, a whole bunch online, and a fair bunch live at the local casino and things like that.
I see. So you kind of got better at poker before you started teaching. It wasn't you were improving while you were teaching.
No, not at all. Poker took a massive backseat when I was a teacher. So for like 4 years, I didn't really play. In fact, it was interesting. Sort of before I was a teacher, when I was at university, I was beating the online game. I mean, I wasn't playing like big stakes. I wasn't making a living from it, but I made enough to get myself through uni. I got my first big score at the Irish Open in 2012 when I came fourth, and I thought, hey, poker's easy. I'll just log on to PokerStars. And I'll just print a lot of money. To this day, I haven't looked at my record on PokerStars because I'm kind of scared. Because I know that I lost a chunk of money playing there just because I came back after 4 years, played the same strategy, and tried to do what the hot shots did and play like 10 tables at a time. And I just wasn't prepared for it.
Yeah, and that was a tough 4 years to admit. Like 2008 to 2012, I think, were maybe the... If I had to pick 4 years when the poker world changed the most, I think it will be those 4 years.
So you can imagine, I mean, I played, when I played live then, I played quite, I would describe it as hyper lag. And that's just so easy to counter online. You just press call. And people just did that. they just pressed the call button and took my money for however long I tried to do the online thing. So, I mean, I never used to play online. I stopped playing online because of that bad experience. It's only the past 8 months that I've came back to the online arena. I was having a downswing in my live game as my sort of reputation in England grew. People basically learned how to counter it, and I went on a downswing. And I spent a lot of time blaming the downswing on the occasional mistake and variance. And every poker player blames variance at some point or another. And I've now taken the new mindset of I will never ever blame variance ever. I don't care if I lose aces 6 times in a tournament. All in preflop, I'll look at what else I could have done differently in that tournament. It's very easy to look to say, yeah, I lost because of variance. Every poker player says that, and it's wrong. You've got to look at every single mistake. And because I was blaming variance too much, I had a big live downswing. And it wasn't until I started playing online that I was able to sort of identify my mistakes. Using PokerTracker, my friends helped me with all the different tricks that PokerTracker can do to analyze your play. I think it was about 8 months ago, I got like a coaching job with a company, and I met this group of players who, I'm not at that coaching job anymore, but I met this group of players who I was coaching, and it's since working with them that I've really been able to improve my game and been able to get some online results and start doing well online and play regularly online and, you know, make some money playing that way.
Can you say a little bit more about the poker tracker thing? I mean, is there anything you would recommend that you consider kind of a non-obvious use of poker tracker for finding leaks, I guess?
Well, I mean, you guys will be a lot more versed with it than me. Like I say, I've only been playing for 8 months. But it's just looking at, I mean, there's a million different statistics that poker tracker can give you. For example, even just looking at something as simple as your 3-bet statistic and looking at how you make up that statistic, what hands you choose to put into that statistic and monitoring your lifetime sort of 3-bet stat to see what mistakes you're making. And once you've looked at the simple things, like how often you 3-bet, you can start looking at more complicated things, like how often you check raise, how often you flat call preflop, how often you, you know, all these different things. How often you fold your big blind? you know? And I don't know, in the past 8 months, I found so many, like, just little tiny niggly things that I've been able to tweak and improve my game with.
Yeah, I think that's really important. You know, I think a lot of people tend to say, oh, that's just a small thing. I don't have to worry about that. And at some point, like, it's only small things that yeah. you can improve. You know, like, hopefully by the time you're a decent poker player, you don't have, like, huge glaring holes in your game. And so, you know, people who are like, oh, that's a marginal spot. I'm not going to worry about the marginal spots. Like, you know, you're not going to get dealt yeah. aces anymore often. Like, you have to, the only way to get better is to, you know, to stop making small mistakes and start making slightly better decisions in those smaller spots.
Absolutely. I think that's pretty much all that's left nowadays is the small spots you can tweak, you know? Because everyone's so much better than they were 10 years ago. So it really is a case of who works hardest at this game. They're the people who make the money. And if people have the mindset of, oh, I'm not worried about this small hand, it's only a tiny little thing, how often does this situation arise? You have to analyze it. You must analyze the tiny little parts of your game. Because if you don't, and someone else does, they're going to get your money.
So the analysis for you mostly looks like doing poker tracker work independently and then reviewing hand histories with friends. That's kind of the majority of your study.
Yes, I guess. One other thing I did, like I said, I used to be a teacher, and I had this coaching gig with this group. I don't think there's anything better for learning the game than teaching. Mm-hmm. Like, even if you look at a reasonably simple subject, like continuation betting was one of the opening lessons I planned. I used to plan it just like I used to plan the lessons for the kids at school, which might sound a little silly, like when I'm pitching it to adults. But learning takes...
No, it's great. I mean, I think that's the biggest problem, even with, like, instructional videos and stuff, is that you just really see how many poker players have no idea how to teach.
Yes, indeed. I mean, there's some absolute sicko poker players out there who can't deliver a presentation. I mean, no offense to them, because that's not their background. But being a teacher, I've
No, seen... but they are taking people's money to deliver presentations.
Okay, that gives, so a little bit of offense to them, I guess. But yeah. So one thing I'm very... So even looking at, I don't know, a simple thing like how often you continuation bet, once you plan a PowerPoint lesson around that, even a little sort of seemingly common thing, which, I mean, everyone continuation bets nowadays, you can really break it down into really nitty-gritty spots. And, you know, you're looking at how often you continuation bet. And if you continuation bet too much, it's bad. If you continuation not enough, it's bad. And picking the sort of the nitty-gritty hands that you're not sure if you continuation bet or not, and finding out the pros and cons of continuation betting them. And, you know, there's nothing better for learning your own game than really delving into even a simple, seemingly simple spot like that and trying to teach it to somebody else. Because if you can teach something to somebody else, there's literally no better learning tool than that.
And that was like a group coaching thing you were doing, like for multiple students at once?
Yeah, I had like 10 cats in my stable at one point. I would take sessions of maybe two or three of them at a time and deliver presentations over Skype with them. But it was great because I'd deliver a presentation to the first three on a topic, and then I'd have to massively update it for the next group because they'd be like, well, hang on, this is wrong. You can do this because these guys are great. I mean... They're able to spot things that I don't spot. Humans are terrible at spotting their own mistakes. Absolutely all of them. So having a group who you can talk openly and honestly about with your mistakes and be able to point mistakes out to you is absolutely fantastic. And I love these guys for that. But yeah, I'd have to like really tweak my lessons for the next group coming along because I'd be a little bit embarrassed because I thought, oh my God, I shouldn't be doing that. That's bad. That's losing money. Quick, fix it for the next guys. don't look like an idiot to everybody. At least look good to some of them, you know?
How do you, this is something it's been a big issue for me as a coach, which is that some people get turned off if you say, look, if you want somebody to be the back of the book and just to give you all the answers, that's not me. I don't have all the answers. There are people who are better than me. What I'm better at is communicating information and diagnosing leaks in your game. And both as a book author and as a coach, I find a lot of people who just aren't interested in that. They want the back of the book. Have you found the same thing?
Yeah, and we got rid of those players. if they're not willing to work hard, then they're not going to make money playing poker.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. If you don't work hard at this game, you know, you'll get some run good. Like, I had some run good to get myself started in this thing. But if I hadn't worked hard, you know, the poker king would have all that money back, you know? You just have to be able to work hard.
Yeah.
But like you were sort of alluding to there, getting your players to find out the answer for themselves mm-hmm. is the best thing. So it's very easy to just give a presentation and say, see bet this hand, don't see bet that hand. Raise this hand pre-flop, don't raise this hand pre-flop. It's much better to question your students and tease the information out of them. And if they think they're making a mistake, rather than pointing out that mistake, if you can get them to realize it through like probed questioning, that's a much better way of getting them to learn. So, and for me, I think the most important thing for being a coach isn't even the nitty-gritty stuff. It isn't, you know, oh, you should see bet here, oh, you should check risk here, et cetera, et cetera. The most important thing I found was just building that confidence, because every single poker player has lapses in their confidence, every single one. And poker can be so, so crushing for that, because if your confidence is low and you're not going to make the best plays. Nobody is going to make the best plays when their confidence is low, and they're going to lose. And how are you supposed to get your confidence back up when you're losing? So it's this vicious cycle that can be so, so hard to break out of. So as a coach, your number one goal is to build confidence. So when you're doing hand, whenever I did a hand history with these guys, I would never, ever, ever start on a negative, ever. Like if they open raise with a hand that they shouldn't open raise with, I would even go so far as to like sort of let it go until I could say something positive and then come back to it. Just because if you start on a negative, that's really crushing for confidence as well. This is a trick I learned with students. I had a kid actually go absolutely nuts. He'd done something really good on a piece of coursework, but he'd done one thing wrong, and I started the conversation telling him the thing that went wrong, and this kid went absolutely ballistic. He was a kid with you know, some special needs. He was a lovely kid, but you know, he had a tendency to flare up. So that was an extreme example. But yeah, as a coach, there's nothing more important than building the confidence of your students. So.
Yeah, I think that was good for me to hear. I've probably been guilty of committing those errors. What do you miss about your teaching job? What did you like so much about it?
I loved everything about it. The only thing I didn't miss, I don't know what it's like from where you guys... Wait, where are you guys from, by the way?
I'm from Baltimore originally, but I've lived a variety of different places.
Fair enough.
And actually, I've worked in public schools in a variety of different places as well.
Oh, excellent. So you might have some... Well, I mean, in England, teaching is a little bit messed up right now, just because the government don't have someone in charge who used to be a teacher. They've just got some friend of the Prime Minister who's doing the job and getting the pay packet. So everything that's coming up from on high is kind of screwing the whole show. So the ins and outs of it is that the workload is absolutely massive, and it's only getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's the only thing I don't miss, is that I'm working 60 and 70 hours a week in such an important job. And I do think teaching is the most important job there is just terrible, not just for the teachers, but for society in general. But as far as things that I miss absolutely everything else about it. My colleagues were great. I had a great rapport with all the colleagues at my last school. The kids were fantastic. The kids are so on point. Like, especially young kids, they can just pick up on things that adults just don't see, and they can solve problems that adults just don't get.
What age were you working with?
I worked with year 7 to year 11, so that's like 11-year-olds to 16-year-olds. 11 to 18-year-olds.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. I absolutely loved working with the youngest kids, the year sevens.
See, I've always said, I've done a lot of work with high school students, and I've always said I couldn't work with what we would call middle school, which is probably like 10 to 13 or 11 to 14, right in that neighborhood. I've done a little work with younger kids, I've done a lot of work with older kids, but right in the middle, I can't see myself doing that.
I love them all. I absolutely adored it. The one benefit of, because the school I was at, year 7, was the lowest year group. So if you had a class from year 7, you could kind of mold them a little bit. They'd get used to you and you'd get used to them. You'd get used to their tendencies. They'd get used to your quirks as a teacher. So by the time year 8 came along and year 9 came along, you'd have this really good relationship that was really good for their learning.
Oh, so you got to see the same students over multiple years?
Yeah. So you could kind of almost mold them to your teaching style, and they'd mold you to their learning style. So you get to know these kids over 3 years, and I really miss that. In fact, I'm still in touch with a couple of the students because I was friends with parents of the students via Facebook, so I can talk to the parents and the parents can let me know how their kids are still doing. You know,
that's nice.
Yes, such and such has gone to university, such and such is doing this, and it's beautiful, it's fantastic. So I really miss that. And the more I'm talking about it, the more I'm missing it, actually. I might sack off the Sunday grind and go looking for a teacher job.
How conscious were the students of your budding poker career?
Not at all until it just happened. Like I say, I barely played poker as a teacher. You know, the occasional Friday night with my friends and whatnot. So when I got the big score and I had this massive decision between the job I loved, the kids I loved, the staff I loved, and the dream, as it were, of playing professional poker with a bankroll, traveling to all over, traveling to Barcelona, traveling to Vegas, traveling to everywhere playing poker, I was absolutely torn. It was heartbreaking trying to make that decision. In fact, one of the kids made me cry on the last day, like with the lovely things she just said, you know, wishing me fond farewells and all the best and whatnot. So yeah, I forgot the question there.
I was asking, you know, specifically about the poker, like how
oh, right, aware, yeah, yeah, what that... they knew. Well, nothing at all until it happened, and then when it happened, I was, like I say, I was friends with some of their parents via Facebook, and you know, my Facebook feed got updated with, you know, I've came fourth and I've won all this money. So the kids of those parents found out, so the friends of those kids found out, and the friends of those friends found out, and it sort of spread like wildfire like that. So that's how they eventually found out. And most of them were, I mean, they were all happy for me. They were all, you know, curious and interested and whatnot. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I kind of wish, one thing I missed out on at the school I was at was teaching a gambling awareness lesson. I had taught them, but never as a poker player, always as a professional teacher. My wife was actually kind enough, and her mother, my wife's a teacher, she's a maths teacher, and her mother was the head at the same school. And they were, oh, actually, no, the mother's at the head of the current school, but anyway, never mind. My wife was good enough to have me into her school to give a gambling awareness talk to all her year 11 kids, which was a lot of fun. So I got to teach them a little bit about poker, a little bit about the thought process behind poker, and a little bit about sort of almost money management and gambling awareness, and, you know, got to talk to them about their philosophies on gambling. It was interesting seeing some kids saying, nope, don't gamble, it's bad. And you know what? That's absolutely fine. If that's your opinion, that's absolutely fine. And some kids saying, I don't really know about gambling. Let's talk about it a bit more. So, yeah.
It's hard for me to imagine that happening in a U.S. school. I feel like there's so much, paranoia about potential, yeah, like lawsuits or like exposing kids to anything remotely scandalous, and then just, you know, there's so much of a stigma against gambling, which I think maybe you don't have quite as much in the UK.
I guess it might not be quite as much, but there is still a stigma. I think a couple of the parents were uneasy when they heard that I was going to be leaving my teaching job to be a gambler for a living, which, you know, when you say it like that, it does sound absolutely nuts.
Well, and from your kid's perspective, like, it just looks like easy money. Like, it looks like you just came out of nowhere and won all this money playing poker.
I tried to reinforce that it's not easy money so many times before I left. My biggest nightmare was that they would, you know, steal a parent's credit card, log on to PokerStars or whatever, and just think, hey, if Mr. Simpson can do it, why can't I do it? And just, you know, and just lose all the parents' money or something. So I was like, look, it is not easy. It is not easy. Don't do it. Work hard, and if you're good at it, and you're good at maths, and you're going to work hard, then you can do it. But, you know, yeah. That was a really big fear of mine, the thought of my students potentially doing harm to themselves via gambling.
I want to hear more about this gambling awareness.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I remember teaching it before I got my big score. In my phone class, they were absolutely excellent at it. I did a lesson about the roulette wheel. And I give all the kids a number, and I span the roulette wheel, and I put a pretend pound, there was pretend pound coins I'd made out of cardboard or whatever, and I put one of them in my back pocket and paid out the other 36 that the roulette wheel would pay out to one lucky, you know, inverted commas, student. And I said, right, well, who made money there? And they were so, so good, I barely had to teach them at all. That every one of them just pointed at me and said, you made money, because they'd recognized that I hadn't paid the student who spanned the number on roulette the fair amount. You know, so I had to guide them a little bit through why they hadn't been paid the fair amount. But they were great. They picked up instantly that, you know, I'm taking a pound out of every spin. That's essentially how roulette works, because they don't pay fair. But yeah, after teaching it that way and then teaching it as a professional, well, a budding professional poker player at my wife's school, that was kind of daunting, because I had my wife, who's a fantastic mathematician, in the room. So I'm doing a maths presentation to my wife, which is, you know, scary. I'm also doing a maths presentation to my wife's boss, the head of maths. So I'm like, okay, really can't be getting this wrong. Really need to be on point about this. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. A lot of it was talking about sort of the morality behind it. And is it right?
Morality, you said?
The morality, yeah. So is it right or wrong to be gambling? I'm talking about just the kids' opinions and sharing the kids' opinions and giving my opinion, stuff like that. Some of it was talking about odds. Like the roulette wheel, I think I used a poker hand example. I used a simple example just to flip, you know, a pocket pair versus ace king, and if you've got the right pot odds, you can call and make money. Yeah.
And how aware of poker were they? Like, did you have to explain the rules to them, or were most people, you know, kind of familiar with the basic idea of, you know, Texas Hold'em, or what kinds of hands beat what kinds of hands?
They weren't familiar with what hands beat what kind of hands at all. Okay. They kind of knew. I think if you give them a deck of cards and some pretend chips, they'd know the rules. At least a few of them would know the rules, mm-hmm. And be able to, you know, put a game together and, you know, throw some chips around and whatnot. But as far as the actual order of hands and things like that, you know, they were only 15, 16 years old. It wasn't something many of them had learned.
Okay, sorry. So I interrupted you. You were teaching them about ace king versus pocket twos.
Oh, right. Yeah, and just talking about the pot odds and questioning them. Okay, so you're a slight underdog. There's this much in the money. It's going to cost you this much to call. What should you do? And, you know, in fact, credit to them, they were able to say, well, we're going to call because we're going to win this much of the time and we've got this pot odds, so we're going to make money. So, I mean, they were my wife's top set kids, so the brightest kids in, I think it was year 11. So they were pretty on point. I mean, I'm pretty sure most of them are better mathematicians than me by that time. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun talking to sort of the younger generation about their opinions on poker and their opinions on gambling and things like that, you know, because it does have a sort of shady reputation almost. It's still, even though it just isn't shady at all anymore. I mean, well, okay, there is a shady side to it, but in general, it's not. It's a skill game, and it's, you know, especially in England, I think it's quite an honourable skill game as well. So yeah.
Did any of their opinions surprise you?
No, I wouldn't say surprise, but I mean, I was already expecting to have a diverse set of opinions from it. I think my opening question was, what was my opening question? It was along the lines of, when should you gamble, or something like that. I think that was my opening question as the kids were sort of coming in the room.
That's a good question.
Yeah, so when should you gamble? And some kids were very, you could sort of almost tell what their parents had taught them. No, you shouldn't. It's wrong. Don't do it. Or, you should gamble when you know you're going to win. And, you know, things like that.
So. It's not really gambling at that point. But,
exactly. So that would be the conversation that sort of spread from that. It's not gambling if you know you're going to win. So I was like, well, I'm a poker player. I don't know I'm going to win, but I think if I do this long term, I can make better decisions than other people and, yeah, go from there.
Well, I don't want to keep you for too long, and I feel like we've left a couple of stones unturned. Do you want to talk about how you proposed to your wife?
Oh, right. This is a fun one. So my wife, her opinion on gambling was a little bit conservative when we first met. Like, she actually had a few friends. I don't know which ones. She never let on. But some of her friends were telling her to be cautious for going out with a gambler. So this was...
Were you a gambler at the time, or did you meet teaching?
I was a teacher. Actually, we met doing our teacher training together and reconnected through Facebook.
Okay, so you were still playing poker at the time that you met her?
I wasn't playing. This is before the Irish Open fourth place finish, so I was literally Friday nights with the boys and things like that. I'd go to the race.
So this was during the period when you were playing very little poker?
Right, but still a recreational gambler. So like so I'd go to the horse races with my dad every now and then and have a few quid on the ponies. That kind of
thing. That was enough to raise eyebrows?
Yeah, exactly. So my wife, coming from a very conservative background, got thrown into this world. And this world is nuts. The poker world is this absolutely insane place where stupid amounts of money change hands for stupid reasons sometimes. Mm-hmm. So for her to go from her conservative background into this world was a huge thing. And full credit to her, she trusted me. We'd only been together like 3 or 4 months when I got that fourth place finish. She trusted me, and we'd already been quite committed to each other. You know, I guess we started quite fast, and we were very close very quickly. And despite this sort of big scary thing of I have to gamble for a living for a year instead of having this teaching job, she stood by me through it because she realized it was a once in a lifetime opportunity to go for it with the opportunity that the company was given. And she stood by me, and we had a hell of a year together. She got to come to some of the places I traveled to, but like I said, poker and teaching just don't line up, so she didn't get to come to all the places. So there would be times when I would go away for 2 weeks, like to play an APT or whatever, like, and just not be able to spend any time with her because I'm in a different country. But she stood by me the entire year, and I got back to the Irish Open that I won. And, well, Dublin's very special to me and Emma, obviously, because we created so many great memories there. I was going to propose at this little place called St. Stephen's Green in Dublin, which is this lovely little park in Dublin. If you ever get a chance to go to Dublin and go to St. Stephen's Green, go. And I was going to do it feeding the ducks, because that's just the silly thing we do. Go and feed the ducks and enjoy the sunshine. There's nothing better for me and Emma. But when I made the final table 2 years in a row, I kind of realized that all my family would be watching and all her family would be watching. So I decided to do it there and then at the final table, no matter where I busted out, I was going to do it. So I had the ring in my pocket for the entire final table, which was kind of weird.
Do you feel like that gave you more or less nerves? I mean, I guess in some sense, the poker stuff doesn't seem like such a big deal at that point.
The poker wasn't as big a deal at all. Like, looking back at it, like, it was 265,000 euros for first. Like, that's a silly amount of money to be playing for, and I wasn't that nervous about it. And then, all of a sudden, when the tournament finished, then I got really, really nervous really, really quickly, because it was all of a sudden, right, I've actually got to do the more important thing now. I've got to make this massive life-changing decision. I've got to propose. Like, if you watch, like, it's kind of embarrassing, but there's a video of me in the internet somewhere of me proposing to Emma, and it's like my exit interview with the tournament, and I can't speak. The interviewer is talking to me, and I'm trying to, like, just form coherent sentences, and I just can't, because I'm that nervous about proposing to my wife, my fiance at the time. I'm just this bumbling mess on camera, and every time I watch it, I just cringe, because I'm like, just say a sentence. You've said lots of sentences in your life. Just say a sentence. A little bit embarrassing, but yeah, and thankfully she said yes.
Yeah, was that a sweat, or were you pretty confident in the?
Our brother came out with the best one. He said I could have proposed with a Cheerio, and she still would have said yes.
Did you feel that at the time, or were you worried?
No, I felt that at the time. I was pretty confident.
I imagine you have to be to do it that publicly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that could have been a sick rub down. Nah.
You're the not, unhappiest you're not man to ever win 265,000 euros.
Nah, you ain't for me. I'm not interested. See you later.
Oh. Yeah, I feel like you kind of did that backwards. You're supposed to ditch the woman after you have a big win.
Oh, Jesus. I'm not going to let her listen to this now. No way. Never ditch Emma. She's a good one. She's like, as far as other things that are important in a poker player's life, having a good rail is probably, it could be the most important. And aside from my poker player friends who are a rail, Emma's probably the best rail there is. Like, whenever I travel, it's kind of rare that she can come with me because of the teaching holidays, but whenever she does, my edge in whatever tournament I'm playing when she's with me is like just tenfold bigger, just because she's so good to me when I'm playing. You know, she knows that I can get stressed out, and she knows exactly how to take care of me when I'm stressed out. She knows the little things that'll bring me down off the ceiling and stop me worrying about, you know, day two and who the hell's to my left and whatever the hell else I'm going to worry about. And she helps me out. In fact, you know what the best thing she does? If I'm away and I'm playing and I don't get time to look on the Hendon mob at my opponent, if I've got my table drop, she'll do it for me. And she'll send it to me via messenger. And she'll be like, okay, so seat one has got 100,000 chips. He's cashed in this many tournaments, and his lifetime ends are this. There you go. And you'll give me the, and she'll give me the highlights for every single player. It's great.
Yeah, my partner does that for me too.
Yeah, my wife also. It's fantastic.
It's superstars, right? It's so good. It's so important.
Yeah.
What you said that she was understanding of the idea of you taking a year off to play poker because it seemed like a once in a lifetime opportunity. What was the conversation around continuing to do it after that year?
Yeah, it kind of just sort of kept happening. Like, the idea was that I'd do it for one more year, and then the idea was I'd do it for one more year after getting a big score, and then I'd do it for one more year after it went well, and it just sort of kind of keeps getting extended, and we keep sort of coming back to the subject sort of every now and then, sort of what's the lifetime plan, because it's a stupid profession we're in, it really is, because money is this really difficult thing to come by, especially in poker when fluctuations can just drive you insane and they can cause so much worry. For her to stand by me when I'm, you know, when I'm throwing money around like the way you've got it was, I mean, I say throwing money around, I'm really cautious with my money, but you know, you're investing a lot of money in any given week, any given month. For her to stand by me with sort of that kind of financial fluctuation is just fantastic, you know? So yeah, we keep coming back to the subject every, I don't know how often, maybe every few months, and just sort of reassessing where we are in life and how's poker going? How are you feeling about teaching? Do you want to go back to teaching and stuff like that, you know?
How much do you feel like, I mean, I know you talked about poker really kind of, I don't know if passing you by is quite the right word, but that a lot changed in 4 years, and you had some catching up to do after taking 4 years off.
I had a lot of catching up to do. Seriously, if you guys can find me on your old hand histories, you'd be like, what's this guy doing? Why is he clicking those buttons? What is he doing? Sorry, I interrupted you. What were you saying?
Well, I was going to ask, how much do you think the same thing is happening with teaching? I mean,
That's a good question. Like, the day-to-day job is making sure kids are happy and healthy and building their confidence. That's never going to change. That fundamental is never going to change. As far as England goes, the current government has really screwed the pooch with a whole bunch of things. They've, like, made changes that they shouldn't have, at least in my opinion. And the workload is getting higher and higher and higher and higher. Like, if I didn't occasionally argue with Emma, she would probably be working 80-hour weeks. It's only because I stop her doing so many. Because she just wants the best for the kids. But they can't afford to hire the amount of staff that, in my opinion, they should hire to give the kids the best. So Emma takes it upon herself to do the jobs of two or three people at times. And so
yeah, that's so frustrating, the way they kind of take advantage of essentially the good-heartedness of teachers, where, you know, they'll just kind of keep putting more on them and then kind of make it like, well, if you don't do this, the kids are going to be screwed.
It's the most infuriating, frustrating, awful thing in the world. And every time I think about it, my blood boils. Like, right now, just having this little conversation, my shoulders are hunched, I just feel ill thinking about all these teachers in the country who are doing the darndest to make kids in the next generation good, happy, healthy, productive people. And it's like, there's not many more important jobs than that.
Yeah, it's just like they keep trying to find new digits to stick in the holes in the dikes.
Exactly.
And I guess the people further up feel like they can keep popping more holes in the dikes because the teachers are going to keep growing more digits to to plug them.
And eventually it'll break. And right. there'll be a big crash. That's what I think it'll happen. So, yeah, very frustrating.
Well, let's end on a happier subject.
Let's end on a happier subject, definitely.
So you've got WSOP coming up. What are you planning on playing?
Lots of things. Pretty much, I'm a bit of a hold'em one-trick pony, actually. I keep meaning to learn other games. I mean, I know the rules, but playing $1,000 Omaha tournament would be a little indulgent because I'm not a professional Omaha player. I keep wanting to develop the other parts of my game, my other games, so that I can enjoy the other games at the World Series. So for me, it'll be the main event, which I actually won a seat for online. So that's all good and paid for anyway.
Have you played that before?
I played it. This will be my fourth time playing it this year.
Okay.
I'll be playing all the everything between sort of $500 and $1,700. I think that there's a couple of $1,650 games at Planet Hollywood when I get out there that look particularly appetizing. So, you know, all the Hold'em stuff, and hopefully I'll pull my finger out and learn some Stud and some Omaha to a good degree, a good enough degree that I can chase those bracelets in next summer, you know?
We've talked to a couple people. Sam Grafton comes to mind in particular, who kind of deliberately avoid the WSOP because they say the online games are so much softer during that time, and with all the travel expenses involved in doing the WSOP, it kind of seems like they can actually make more money staying at home and playing online then.
I don't blame them. I mean, I've been I'm going a week later than I did last year, and this week there's all kinds of craziness online. There's all kinds of, I know, these players must still be playing, like, throughout the year. It's not like they only play once people go out to the World Series. But I guess the field is just diluted less. There's less sharks in the tank, as it were. So that the crazy players sort of, they must stand out a little bit more. The games are definitely a lot softer in these, how long's the series last? 8 weeks or something like that? The games are definitely softer. I can't blame anyone at all for staying at home. Because a month in Vegas is a damn long time. 2 months in Vegas is an extremely long time to be out in Vegas.
I couldn't even imagine 2 months. I've never even done a month. 3 weeks is about my max.
I've done a month before, and that's so hard. Like, especially when the best tournament's at the end, so you've done a month of grinding, and you know, right. That month can go either way. That month can be soul-destroying. You know, turning up to Rio, bust, go home. Turn up to the Rio, bust, go home. That can kill you, you know, at least emotionally. And so to go through that for a month and then rock up to a 10k event buy-in, it's a little bit crazy to me. But you know, there's players who do it. Players probably with stronger mindsets than me.
Players with weaker mindsets who do it too, and it doesn't go well for you.
There definitely are. I'm doing 3 weeks this year, which I think is a healthier balance. But I did a month last year, and it's a big strain on me and Emma. I miss Emma after like a weekend. So a month is just crazy. And she misses me too, so it's better to do, you know, a slightly shorter World Series. And like you say, the online games are a lot softer. So I mean, I've talked to guys who get like a quarter of the yearly online income from this 2 month period, because you know the sharks are away, so you know there's more money for them to harvest up.
What's the reason for going to WSOP? You just enjoy it?
I want a bracelet. I'm a glory hog, all right? I know there's people out there who think that's crass. I don't care. I want a bracelet. It's shiny, it's pretty, and I want one, all right?
Dara O'Carney calls this the Olympic element of poker, which I think is a classier way of saying the same thing.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, let's go with Dara's idea. That's a good idea, yeah. Slightly more classy than me, Dara is.
Anything that we've left on the table yet? Anything you wanted to talk about we haven't gotten around to?
I think we talked about pretty much everything I thought about talking about. I'm happy. That was great. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, we certainly enjoyed talking to you. I have a tremendous amount of respect for teachers. So that was,
thank you very much.
To hear about that. And to your wife as well.
Excellent. Thank you. I'll send that on. Thank you.
And hopefully I can buy you a drink at some point when you're not in the unlikely event you bust out before the final table of any of those tournaments.
Obviously. That sounds great. I'll be in Vegas in like a week's time, so bumping into you guys for a beer, that would be absolutely fantastic. That would be cool.
I'll be out there in July. It'd be great.
Excellent. Brilliant.
Yeah, Ian, do you know what day you're playing 1A, or which day 1 of the main event you're playing?
Day 1C. Being an online qualifier means I've got to play day 1C. So
that's the best one anyway.
The ideal for me actually is to wake up every morning as if I'm going to play. Like, I'll wake up on day 1A and go through my routine of I'm going to play. And as I get to my hotel room door, I sort of assess how I'm feeling. So, did I get enough sleep? Did I get enough breakfast? Am I feeling on point? And if I'm not, well, I've got two more tries at that morning routine, because I get excited before the main event. I get excited before any poker event, and being excited really screws with my sleep. I'm not a really good sleeper at the best of times. Mm-hmm. So having three opportunities to get a good sleep is definitely a good thing for me. But this year I have to play day 1C because of the way the online qualification thing works. So hopefully I'll just sleep well and just drill it, all right?
On day 1B, we're having a meetup for our podcast community. I mean, we'll be inviting a bunch of our guests as well.
Oh, really?
But we'll have listeners and stuff. And that's going to be like 10 a.m. to noon at the Gold Coast bowling alley. So I don't know if you're staying at the Rio, but Gold Coast right next door.
I'm probably
a little early for a beer, but that'll be the easiest place to pin both of us down.
Says you, I'll be on England time. That's a great time.
I was about to say, yeah, I guess it'll be like 5 p.m. for you. So.
All right, that sounds great. So between 10 and noon on...
10 and noon on Sunday the 10th.
Excellent. I will endeavor to be there and I'll catch up with you guys. That sounds great.
And I think there's a decent chance Dara will be there too.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, Dara's a gent. I've got to spend some time with Dara and David Lappin and Dara Davey this past month in Malta. I was out there for the Unibet Open. So it was great getting to know them guys a little bit better. So yeah, that'd be great.
One of our regular guests was a math teacher for... I don't know exactly how long, but for quite a while in the U.S. I think you'd probably enjoy meeting him as well.
Oh yeah, cool. What's he called?
Carlos is his name.
Carlos. Okay, cool.
I'll send you a link to one of our interviews with him. You'll like him.
Cool. That sounds great.
All right. Really nice talking to you, Ian.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Take care. Bye now.